Okay, I'm here with Cameron McKeown once again. This is our sixth recording, and we're actually finished our introductory overview, I think, and we're going to go to the beginning of my pamphlet, my broadside, my book, my menu that I put together back in October, just before the election. It's called What You/We Didn't Know About President Trump. So we have Cameron, one of the few people who has read it, and we're interested in what he has to say about it, what he notices. So bringing up my copy, where is my copy? Have you got yours there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Right this second. All right, mine's coming up. What do you notice first off?
Well, I'm a little worried that when we talk about the early pages of the book, that we're going to get back into the introduction that you're hoping to leave, because the thing that strikes me at the start is you're wanting to get out of the cul-de-sac of typical things that are said about McLuhan, medium is the message, global village, media ecology.
And the tetrad.
That's right. And then you get into the question of how the intuitive man takes precedence over the analytic man.
Yes. It
comes from a letter McLuhan wrote in 1959. And if memory serves, McLuhan just before then had been in Winnipeg. And he had given the substance of that letter to a men's business club in Winnipeg. So to me, that's very interesting that McLuhan sort of kept a foot in his in the place that he was not born in, but grew up in and remained in from age 4 or 5 until 22 or 23.
Let me say this. The letter that he wrote that I'm quoting is to a businessman he didn't know. So it's significant that he got the idea of writing to businessmen after speaking to them.
Yes. Yes.
Maybe he might have been, that person might have been recommended to Marshall from somebody at the meeting in Winnipeg.
It's possible. I think the it was written to a man by the name of Morgan.
Yeah.
I think, wasn't Morgan an executive in McLean Hunter or a firm like that? I'll quickly look that up.
Yeah, I don't recall. You just need to look into the letters.
Yeah, that's where I'm going right now.
But I think, I think the editor, William Toy, remarked on Morgan's response, right? How else would I know it?
He certainly got a note.
Yeah, the guy said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, McLuhan probably liked responses like that.
Yes.
From business people, because that kind of response is honest and doesn't try to eat McLuhan stuff. The academic response is almost always, I know what you're talking about. I know it better. Here's how I digest it, and here's what you should be thinking instead. Right?
Exactly.
And by the way, I'm going to add this to my CV, which is now 98 pages long, and should get me a travel grant somewhere.
Yeah, and if you ever drop by, I might be able to help you. Yeah. That, you know, Edgar Friedenberg, who's quoted in Gutenberg Galaxy, he did the book The Vanishing Adolescent. He was a famous intellectual in America at that point, and then he left America because of Vietnam War, went to Dalhousie in Halifax. So I sat in on his classes for 5 years in 73 to 77, something like that. And he once told me that he met a major minister who'd be in the news back then, you know, minister of trade or something.
Yeah.
And I guess the minister listened to Friedenberg talk, and then after came up and said, here's my card. If you ever need any help, give me a call. So I guess he thought Friedberg was a guy wandering in off the street and presented his problems to the group. But the other story Friedberg told me is that he was on a panel and in 1970 or so, and Morris McLuhan, he was looking forward to being on a panel with McLuhan, and Morris McLuhan showed up. And when Morris introduced himself, he said that Marshall was an only child. And Friedberg told me he was shocked. He kind of didn't respect McLuhan anymore after that. Like, he thought, what, that crazy family. So I thought that was an incredible inside statement.
That's a great example of Irish humor.
Is it?
Right? Irish. Oh, definitely. Irish, yeah. McLuhan's dad was a master of Irish humor.
Yeah.
McLuhan, I think it's in Take Today, but I'm not exactly sure. But he gives an example of Irish humor. And he says, an Irish bull. Do you know the story of the Irish bull?
I don't recall it.
If you see three cows standing in a field, the one that is lying down is the Irish bull.
And that's funny?
Very funny, yeah. Three cows standing, and the one that is lying down is the Irish bull.
Oh, he says, if you see three cows standing, and the one...
Yeah.
Okay.
The cows as opposed to bull, right?
Right. If you see three cows standing...
Yeah.
The one lying down is the bull. So there's four?
No, there's only... No, I mean, the whole thing turns on the fact that that it's supposed to be cows with no bull, and they're supposed to be standing and not lying. And the slipperiness of the story is the Irish humor, a.k.a. the Irish bull.
Yeah, bullshit. Okay.
Yeah.
I must have read that. Sounds familiar. I didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, it's very funny. It's very funny. And it's exactly analogous to Marshall's an only child said by his brother.
Who would ever say that? I mean, he and Marshall were maybe a hidden comedy team, at least privately.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that Marshall used to send Maurice out to talk for him.
That's right.
Maurice was a great wordsmith, and that was both a source of pride with Marshall and an irritant, because he thought that his brother tended to talk instead of understanding something. Right? And so on the one hand, he appreciated it. It was something that his brother got from his dad, but on the other hand, it pissed him off.
Yeah. Okay. Another story. So, I met Morris when I went to the center in 71. I'd been there many times before, but I went there in 71, and he was the front guy at the front desk that later became George Thompson's role a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And I said, I had come in from Nova Scotia, And he said, it's very dark down there. I was shocked at this rude commentary about where I'd come from. And I said, well, at least it's green. That was all I could come up with. And that was that. So then 4 years later, on a Monday night, I got to meet him again. He was there. And he had not been around. I didn't know where he had gone. But he had actually, I found out later, gone to Sheridan College, you know, out in Mississauga or someplace, and taught right. there. And there's a great video that a student made of Marshall, January 75, teaching at Morris's class. And uh-huh. and Marshall says a lot to the students. It's a very revealing interaction. So
oh,
Morris made... Have you ever seen that? Richard somebody...
No, I haven't. What I find interesting there is, I believe McLuhan's old friend from Winnipeg, Carl Williams, was the head of Sheridan College at that point.
No, Williams was out there at Western University.
No, he became the president of Western in 77, I believe.
He was president when Subliminal Seduction, Wilson Brian Key got in trouble. And Key was teaching at Western, I guess it was Western, one of those places outside in Ontario someplace, you know, far from Toronto. And Williams did not help. He was president. He did not help the faculty flack that Key was getting. And Marshall wrote to him. And I noticed this. I have it. The correspondence, and Williams didn't come through for Key on behalf of Marshall. So I'm pretty sure I'm accurate on that. 73-74, maybe he went to Sheridan. Was he head of Sheridan?
Well, I get a little mixed up with the names of the satellite campuses.
Okay.
The names change, right?
Yeah.
So I think the Mississauga campus started off as maybe Mississauga College, and then it became Sheridan, and unless I'm, you know, compressing two different places together. And I was under the impression that in the middle 70s, that's where Williams was. But...
No, here it is. I just did a quick run through here. Brought him up. Where's this? President's biography. It says David Carlton Williams.
Yeah.
He was president from 67 to 77. Look what it says. Dr. Williams, and this is Western University propaganda, right? You know, it's an inside bio. Dr. Williams' presidency was one of buoyant optimism, during which Western, the university, continued to grow and diversify. The range and depth of its intellectual pursuits, the richness of its cultural life and athletic activity, and the variety of social life on its campus all became more sophisticated as Western matured into a major university. After completing undergraduate studies in his home province of Manitoba, and pursuing graduate studies in psychology at the University of Toronto in 1940. So where's McLuhan? Is at Madison. No, he's in St. Louis at that time, right? 1940. Williams served as an officer in the RCAF during the Second World War. Following the war, he returned to Toronto, where he became vice president of two new colleges at Arundale and Scarborough before being recruited as Western's fifth president. So Arundale, Scarborough were, I guess, parts of the University of Toronto, but that was before 67.
Correct. So I was screwing up 67 with 77.
Right.
I think Arundale is one of the names of the campus in Mississauga.
Yes, I think you're right. What's the one, Sheridan? So let's look up, let's put in Arundale and see what they say. And then... Sheridan.
By the way, can I talk as you're looking that up?
No, I got it here. It is an historical neighborhood located within the central part of the city of Mississauga. the center of the...
That's Arundale, right?
Yeah, the center of the old village is just to the east of the Credit River Valley. A large campus of the University of Toronto, known as University of Toronto Mississauga, is located on the west bank of the river, and that probably is the most recent name. I remember something being called Arundale back in the 60s and 70s, so it used to be, it became the University of Toronto Mississauga. Okay, so now I'll do Sheridan.
Right.
See what happens there.
Both Bissell and Williams were the presidents or the principal, whatever the word is, at Sheridan. And they just before Bissell became the president of UT.
You said who was the other person?
Bissell and then Williams.
Hmm. Yeah, I know Bissell. He was president of University of Toronto in 59 or so. So that would be the 50s.
Yeah.
Let's see. It says here, the Sheridan College Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning, previously called Sheridan College of Applied Arts and Technology, commonly known as Sheridan College, founded in 67. The college of blah, blah, blah. There are campuses in Oakville, Brampton, Mississauga. So it's something on its own. It's not part of the University of Toronto. In 2018, it opened a campus in Brampton in partnership with Ryerson University. So Sheridan is something separate, right? It's not part of the University of Toronto.
Maybe it was part of University of Toronto for a while and then broke off. I don't know, but I was sure that both Bissell and Williams were head of Sheridan. I'd have to do further research to see if my brain is functioning correctly in thinking that. But
yes, but for those that have no interest in what we're pursuing here, it's the way
let
we work.
Just,
it's how you find out new stuff.
That's right. But the note on Williams was mistaken in one respect, and that was, it said that he got out of the RCAF after the Second World War and then returned to Toronto. But that's not the case. He actually returned to Winnipeg.
You just know that, or you're looking at something?
Okay. Recruited back to
Toronto. Just a minute, Cameron. You faded out. I asked you, he went back to Winnipeg. You know that, or you just looked it up?
No, I know that. I'm just speaking off the top of my
head. Right.
Yeah. So he was head of the psychology department in Winnipeg after the Second World War for 2 or 3 years and then got back to Toronto, I think, in 49.
Okay. Well, Bissell was the eighth president of the University of Toronto, 58 to 71. Let's see, where did he go? He served in the Canadian Army. He was made assistant professor at the University of Toronto, 56 to 58. He went to Carleton College, now Carleton University. That's in Ottawa. So he didn't go to Sheridan or any place.
Right. I guess I was thinking of Carleton. Yeah.
Well, I'm just looking up Carl Williams, if I can get a better thing on him. Do they say anything? Carl Williams.
As you're looking that up, let me mention for everybody that Carl Williams and McLuhan went to high school together.
Yes.
And they graduated, I think, in 1927 or 1928. And then both went to University of Manitoba. But because McLuhan first took engineering and then stopped that and went into literature, McLuhan ended up a year behind Williams at U of M.
Okay.
But, basically, they had known each other when they were together in Toronto for 30 years already, around, in the middle 50s.
Yes. The interesting thing about these guys, Williams, McLuhan, and who's the third guy?
Easterbrook.
Easterbrook, who became a student of Harold Innes, they were outsiders. They were invading Toronto.
That's right.
They had a different sensibility, yep. They thought, from Winnipeg.
Absolutely.
So that's an interesting infiltration they did. Okay, so here's Williams. Okay, 1957, I found a photograph of him. He's seen in this photograph lecturing on psychology at the CBC. There they are, getting into media in 1957. He became the first principal of Scarborough College and the vice president for planning Arundel and Scarborough College in 63. Did I already say that? Scarborough College?
Well, that's what we were talking about that, yeah.
Yeah, that was in that other thing. So that is different from Arundel. Right?
Well, I think you just said that he was involved in the planning for both Scarborough and Arundel, didn't you?
Maybe I did. let's see. Going back, Sheridan College, Arundel, Mississauga. Maybe I did.
I wasn't talking about far back. I was talking about what you just said moments ago when you looked up Williams.
What did I say?
Well, I thought you said that I thought you read that he was involved in the planning for Scarborough and Arundel.
Right, but I'm going back to what was said in Western. Maybe they said that.
Okay.
Because I read it. I read something a little while ago.
That's not when you were talking about the picture of him lecturing at the CBC. That's not at the Western blurb.
No.
That's on a page. That's in a University of Toronto page. And I
think
it was there that you read about him.
Okay, so look at this. He, at Western it says, he returned to Toronto where he became vice president of two new colleges at Arundel and Scarborough before being recruited as Western's fifth president. The thing is that Sheridan is linked to Ryerson, because Sheridan's an applied arts technology place like Ryerson. So the point, what we have grandly discovered, Williams did not go to Sheridan.
Wasn't Ryerson a part of University of Toronto up to a certain point?
I don't think so. I never heard of it. It was five religions, Trinity, St. Michael's, something else, four or five religions was made up the University of Toronto. Well, here we go again. Let's look up the history of Ryerson.
These kinds of asides, I don't know if it's very enlightening for the vast public.
No, it isn't. But they should learn how this is how you discover things.
Absolutely. This is dialogue, and this is words and ideas sparking off each other.
Yeah. And right. Okay, campus expansion. Where is the... okay. During the Second World War, some people and the Toronto Board of Education saw a need to provide specialized institutes that would provide educational vocational training for specific jobs for returning veterans. So nothing to do with the University of Toronto. The idea to create institutions that span the gap between secondary education and universities was the result of a trip undertaken by Kerr to Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1943. With Kerr envisioning a similar institute established in Canada. Wow, it's based on MIT. Kerr's effort to establish an institute of this nature led to the Legislative Assembly of Toronto of Ontario to pass this certain act to create vocational schools and technological institutes. Although several new institutes were planned during the war, their establishment was delayed by the advent of the Cold War and the potential need to remobilize. However, with the prospect of war diminished greatly by 1948, the decision was made to open the Ryerson Institute of Technology in August 48. And you know, the school was named after Edgerton Ryerson. That is a relative of Barrington Nevitt.
Huh.
So Nevitt came out of some established level of establishment area of Toronto. But his parents in particular were missionaries in China. So let's see. Edgerton Ryerson had established the Toronto Normal School. Imagine me called Normal. The Toronto Normal School in 1847 on the future site of the Ryerson Institute of Technology. So nothing to do with McLuhan. I mean, University of Toronto.
Right.
So that's Sheridan. Sheridan's a it's a branch in a way, potential branch of Ryerson. At some point, it's like the outskirts, extension of Ryerson.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking, how can we explain how we got here? Carlton.
We got here through the letter that
Morgan
wrote to that's right, and he was a McLean Hunter executive. So for McLuhan, it was interesting both that he was a businessman and that he was in the business of media.
Yes.
Because McLean's is the Canadian monthly magazine.
Right. And so you're looking at the letter now?
Well, vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, at the biography. So that is where, as far as we know, he first said analytic man versus intuitive man. Think he says it anywhere else before that?
I don't know of any like that, but that's it's an interesting way of putting concept versus percept.
Yeah. Yes, intuitive man, which becomes, you know, a huge cliche in the 60s and 70s, being intuitive, but that's due to the electric effect, right?
Yeah, but it's due to the electric effect in two different ways. One way is completely superficial. Everybody was talking about it and had no idea what they were talking about. And then there's a technical way to talk about it, and that is where intuitive man is a person that evaluates percepts.
And that may have come from Mr. Buck, B-U-C-K-E, who was a psychologist, I think, the mentor to Walt Whitman, who did a book on cosmic consciousness. And I thought that was the first time I ever saw somebody using the word percepts back in the 19th century. That fit in here?
Sure. Sure. I mean, as we've discussed in previous conversations, the whole topic of percept is very, very important for McLuhan and for the world today.
Okay, so when one read the letter, when the book came out in 87, so you're saying intuitive man, it would be lucky if you knew he had written on ESP a couple of years before that. And he's thinking ESP or gestural dance and these other factors as part of the meaning of intuitive man. That's important.
Sure.
It doesn't mean you're like, I don't know, you can figure out what a person's personality is or something, you know. It's not, that's too superficial of the meaning of intuitive man.
Correct. Absolutely correct.
Yeah. So just to wrap up here, you got Williams, five members of the explorations group in the 53 period, 53 to 55. It only went 2 years. And he got three Winnipeg boys, Carlton Williams, who becomes president of the university. McLuhan becomes famous. And
Easterbrook.
Easterbrook becomes a well-known follower of the major scholar Harold Innes. So it's pretty amazing that Easterbrook ended up in the same field as McLuhan, so to speak.
Sure. Easterbrook also became, like Innes, a chairman of the Department of Political Economy.
Yeah.
And I think he was the chairman longer than Ennis.
Wow. Yeah, so they're all successful. Are they? Do they get high marks in high school? Did you look into that?
I haven't looked into that. I think Rich Altman in Winnipeg may have looked into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried to look into McLuhan's grades at University of Manitoba, and they wouldn't give them to me.
Mm.
So the same legislation may pose difficulties for the high school.
Right. Okay, so here you have these three guys in high school together, involved with each other.
No. Easterbrook is not in high school. He was in McLuhan and Williams were going to a high school on the south side of Winnipeg, and Easterbrook was on the north side.
But somehow they spent a lot of time talking together, I think even in high school days, or was it once they were in university?
I haven't been able to. Sometimes you get the impression from what McLuhan says that he knew Easterbrook very early.
Yeah.
But how that would have happened, I do not know. Maybe through high school debating societies, something like that. But I haven't been able to confirm that McLuhan knew Easterbrook in high school.
Yeah,
is that they didn't go to the same high school.
Did they go to the university together?
Yes, they and not only did they go to university at the same time, they were in the same engineering class. So I think that when McLuhan took engineering in 1928 at University of Manitoba, I think that's where he met Easterbrook, but I'm not sure.
Right. That's logical. Now, the thing is, I think it's odd to me, if it's true what McLuhan said, they spent a lot of time talking late into the night. And, you know,
right.
I mean, they didn't need much sleep. They go, maybe they slept in or something. You know, I don't know how rigorous university was. But they seemed to be odd in the amount of debating and talking they did. Did many other people have someone that they would talk into nights for years, you know, or into the early morning? That's how it's presented.
Right.
They were really amazingly intellectually active with each other.
Correct. And Winnipeg produced a lot of great talent in those years. It's unclear exactly why it was able to do it. But probably in the case of McLuhan and Easterbrook, they recognized in each other minds that were superior to those of most folks. And they recognized minds in each other that they had to understand if they were going to sort of grow intellectually, grow out of themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So enter into dialogue as a way of being not encapsulated. And then, as you were just saying a few moments ago about their later careers, all three of these people from Winnipeg excelled in Toronto.
Yes.
They may even have thought that the people they encountered in Toronto were relatively dumb.
Yeah, dull.
So when they, for example, when they got the Ford Foundation grant, I think that they may have gone into the whole thing more or less as a lark.
Yeah. Here's one thing, though. Reading Carpenter's explanation of the years just before 53, they didn't like, Carpenter told me, they saw the CIA taking over anthropology and whatever else, cultural studies, whatever it would be. And they purposely went in there to undermine that. That's what Carpenter said to me. Maybe bullshit, and it's a retrospective thing that he made up. But he would name the anthropologists that passed the CIA scrutiny and went on to become establishment guys that Carver didn't like. And people like Dorothy Lee would get kicked out because they weren't controllable. So I saw that McLuhan and Carpenter were trying to be an anti-environment to the situation. Now, maybe it was a lark to apply to the Fordham, you know, because they knew they were quite different and were pretty well going to fool them if they got something, or at least their motives wouldn't be so respectable. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
So, oh yeah, I think what you're saying is correct, but I don't think it's the full picture.
Yeah.
Carpenter and Williams were kind of opposed in all of these things. Williams would take the side of the administration. Carpenter would be the anti-administration
yeah.
side. And I think the genius of McLuhan was that he could be very friendly, very knowledgeable with both these guys.
Yeah.
So Carpenter and Williams hated each other, thought they were pricks. And McLuhan got along just fine with both.
Yeah, and it sounds like Easterbrook was the sly, quiet guy.
I think so. He was, I think, a little bit like Maurice. He was an old enough friend of McLuhan, knew McLuhan well enough, that he could disagree with him all the time.
Yeah.
And he did.
And he
right?
didn't
so
take it
after,
personally. Yeah, he didn't get into
right.
a
and
personality conflict.
After McLuhan died, Easterbrook told somebody, I don't know, maybe Maurice, that he regretted that he had disagreed with everything McLuhan said for his whole life long, right?
Who said that?
Easterbrook.
Yes, because he... somewhere as his reporter, after he read Take Today, he says, "Holy cow, McLuhan might have been on to something." That blew his mind, you know?
Maybe, yeah.
And he hadn't felt that up to that point. So you're saying that he told Morris that he regrets that he argued so much with Marshall?
Yeah. So are you familiar with a book called Speaking of Winnipeg?
No, I don't have that.
All right. Well...
It's is that the one
available.
with Finkel, the interview with
yes.
Finkelstein, Finkelman or whatever?
Yeah, Finkelman.
Yeah, I've read that interview.
Yeah, okay, good. So in that, when McLuhan says anything, then Easterbrook laughs at him and says, "Well, that's not really the case." And that's how the interview goes, basically.
Really?
Right? And yeah, and... you know, the two of them are making fun of the interview form.
Yeah.
Right? McLuhan starts off by saying how the prairie meadowlark is the greatest songbird in the world.
Yeah.
And it's Irish bull again, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, what is Easterbrook?
Well, he's Easterbrook isn't Irish. Well, he's definitely a Protestant, if he was anything. And he probably thought that McLuhan's enchantment with people like Chesterton was wrong-headed.
Yeah, right? He didn't want the book.
Pardon me?
He didn't want the Chesterton book. He gave it to McLuhan.
Correct.
Okay, so you have Carpenter's a wild, energized Marine. Don Thiel used to talk about he was a total Marine sensibility, and he had been may have mentioned this before. He was the assistant to one of the main guys who ran the Nuremberg hearings or investigation of the Nazis. So he would.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he would have found out about the secret importation of Nazis, you know, into the United States military. He might have known a lot about that, and that maybe put him on the outside, you know, as a working class guy, Marine guy, becoming intellectual. He would have an outsider mentality towards the naive establishment because he knew stuff that they didn't know from 1945.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. And now what? And then you had the Jacqueline Tyrwhitt, who was, you know, Gideon's product. So,
that's right.
But
or vice versa. Maybe Gideon's English was never good, and so she became his translator and editor.
Oh.
Yeah, sometime around in the late 40s. So before Chirrut, Gideon's stuff was pretty rough. Space, time, and architecture had been lectures at Harvard, and people had helped him at Harvard University Press to put that into decent English. But then his essays in the 1940s are very rough English. But then he got Chirrut as his editor and translator, and sort of for the rest of his life, I think he died in 66, she was kind of the medium through which Gideon was presented to the English-speaking world.
Okay. Well, side thing, do you know when Morris McLuhan died?
I don't, but I if I had to guess, I'd say around 96.
Okay, because it's curious. There's no obituary. Very hard to find out what happened to him. You know, where did he disappear to once he wasn't teaching at Sheridan anymore? It's odd that there's no record. I may have seen the date in Ottawa, and it would be somewhere in my archives, but I looked for years, couldn't find anything on him. And then maybe I finally saw it there, but I can't remember what it was. Let's see. So, okay, the other important, really important thing is, who is James Joyce's best buddy in his last couple of years?
Well, I guess you're headed towards the Gideons.
That's right. This is really amazing.
Yeah.
You know, space, time, and architecture. That's Finnegan's Wake. It's about maybe even Ulysses. Space, time, and architecture is different media environments. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. And that's not only is it different media environments sort of via suggestion, it is exactly different media environments by intention. So Gideon, in the early 1940s, was playing up the idea that the crisis of Western civilization, as seen in the Depression and then in World War II, was a product of the disintegration of truth. And what Gideon said was that if we're to regain a notion of truth to guide our civilization again, as it once did, what we need is for people from different faculties to speak together and to find the common truth that they already have, but they don't know that they have. Right? So he used the image of an orchestra where everybody was playing in their own little cubicle, a little bit like COVID, actually.
Yeah.
But so the orchestra, everybody's playing in the in their own little cubicle, and they don't know that they have some sort of common orchestration, right? And so for Gideon, the great need of Western civilization is for its best minds to speak together and to enunciate the common truth that they already have, but they don't know. So this is what McLuhan took up, this notion from Gideon, and it's what he presented to the University of Chicago in 1946-47 as what the University of Chicago should support. His proposal wasn't for a new department at UC. It was for UC to help get the money for an independent college.
Independent
the whole
what?
Idea, sorry?
An independent college, did you say?
Yeah, an
okay.
independent college. Yeah. So, you know, he wanted millions and millions of dollars, and they just waved him away. It was, he was asking too much.
Yeah.
But so, but the idea that Gideon had in the early 40s and that McLuhan proposed to UC in the late 40s was the germ of the culture and technology seminar. And what happened to McLuhan in 1953 to 1955 in that seminar is he got knocked away from the ideal that he had from Gideon.
Yeah.
He found out that it may be easy to say that we're going to get these people together and they're going to agree on truth, but it doesn't happen. Right? They just end up yelling at each other. Right? So then he had to find another way to go about it, to go about this. And a couple of years later, he came up with the idea of the medium as the message.
Right. And yet he was always looking for a team to help him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because the essence of this whole thing was that human beings must already have access to truth, because the whole idea of constructing truth is what had led into the cul-de-sac, right? Led into the Depression and the Second World War. So constructing something where the great genius makes a crystal palace, let's say, doesn't work. And what's needed instead is to find out what already binds us.
What binds us?
Yeah. What is the medium that we're already participating in?
Yeah.
In families or in societies.
Okay. Is Gideon the founder of interdisciplinary studies?
Well, I don't know if he was the founder, but he was certainly a very strong proponent of it.
Yeah, and when McLuhan celebrates Gideon and the Mechanical Bride, it's his interdisciplinary mind, I guess, that McLuhan is celebrating, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So he probably by 1950, McLuhan has ideas from Gideon, but he is still in the process of digesting them, and he won't, and probably lifelong, McLuhan will never have a complete handle on Gideon, because Gideon was a very great figure, and there's no such thing as emptying out somebody of that kind of stature.
Great. Okay, so Joyce writes about the Brain Trust in Finnegan's Wake, and I think people know it as the advisors to FDR, you know, three letters, like HCE. Roosevelt had a brain trust or advisors. Maybe people, presidents before that had that. But in my mind, somehow, the intelligence agencies were starting to do it, like Tavistock in England. They started to figure out, you know, they had to coordinate a lot of new aspects once the electrification came in the 20s and 30s. So when they got into the war mode, it was natural for a lot of more involved, a lot of what McLuhan idealized, about coordination or cooperation between different specialisms into a multi-media view. The intelligence agencies were forced to do that leading into World War II.
That's right. But that's a good example of something that could be good or bad, depending on how it's went about its business, right?
Yeah.
So this kind of brain trust can do the devil's work as easily as it can do God's work.
Right, and it's Lewis and the men of 1914. They interact a little bit, but they certainly weren't a team. But they were talking to each other in their art forms. But Lewis was the one who criticized, maybe he thought that the brain trust what the brain trust was going to the devil. And he thought he'd move it out of that. And that and that's what inspired McLuhan. So he's reading Gideon, and he meets the mind of Gideon on another level, interdisciplinary mind, Wyndham Lewis. So he's really getting two different angles on it, you know, by
absolutely.
His...
And that's, he met them both in 1943, I believe.
Yeah, so he may have known of Gideon before that, but yes, they met pretty closely, same time.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously he met one of them before the other. I suspect that he met Lewis before Gideon, but I don't think he knew anything about Gideon before 1943, whereas he had read some Lewis already in 36.
Yeah. No, he knew Lewis better. Now, what's interesting, Pound wanted this too, Ezra Pound. It's interesting how Lewis, Joyce didn't seem to be that kind of guy. Maybe Eliot. But definitely Lewis and Pound were looking to be part of a headquarters in an advisory capacity or researchers or something. They wanted to be part of the brain trust. That's why they developed theories of economics and politics and that, and got into, you know, looking at social credit for Pound. And Lewis is looking everywhere. They are what McLuhan became.
These are two people that couldn't exist in a bureaucratic environment for more than about 11 seconds.
Yes.
Right? Founded Lewis. So
yeah, trying to be part of the bureaucracy or to start one on their own.
That's right. So when these guys have aspirations to be part of the brain trust, what they mean is they wanted to be the brain trust all on their own. Right?
They wanted to be the center for culture and technology.
Absolutely.
Which may be the common bond in the men of 1914. They all desired to be that. And, of course, McLuhan writes about that as an Egyptian kind of art form when he talks about burrows. You know, And he talks about Lewis in that essay. So I'm just thinking right now that McLuhan was just stunned by the people he met and the ideas he encountered. You know, he went in the deep dive, as they say, very early, and thought he was qualified to be part of these people, among them.
Mm-hmm.
And you see in his essays for the Manitoban. He's thinking as a big view manager. Brain trust kind of thinker. Have you noticed that in his Manitoban student articles?
Oh, yeah. Well, he certainly took a very broad view. He always did.
Yeah.
No question about that. He was very, lucky or very gifted with the people that he met. Meeting people of the stature of Lewis and Gideon, more or less by chance.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yep.
Right?
And then Lewis and Innes and Pound, and then Ted Carpenter, and then everybody else he met in the States. In other fields. And that, you know, that's the one thing somebody asked him, I don't know, 60s, 70s, something about how do you look at your life. He says, I was just very lucky. That's how he described himself. A lucky person who had a chance to meet all kinds of, you know, interesting people.
That's correct. But out of all of these great people, he was able to actually make a close connection with only a very few of them.
Yeah.
Harry Scornia was not a great figure by any stretch of the imagination, but somehow he was able to make a connection with McLuhan and be a life-changing figure in the way these other folks weren't.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And just to go back, would you say that we talked about how McLuhan always needed someone to talk to. He had his father when he was a teenager and maybe his mother, but Would you say Easterbrook was his main guy in his late teens, early 20s, or was there someone else you know of in Winnipeg?
Well, I know that he was a debater, and I know that he was part of a small group that used to meet on Monday nights, by the way, used to meet on Monday nights to discuss works of literature. This is outside of regular classes.
Yeah.
So I think McLuhan was a sort of a natural born talker that he got from his father.
Yeah.
And just his whole life long, he was talking to people as a mode of talking to himself, a mode of thinking.
Yes.
Right. And this often pissed people off, because they felt like they were being used by McLuhan to talk to himself rather than talking to them.
Right. Yep, that's a good way to put it. Okay, so what, again, we get so involved talking about McLuhan, but I'm trying to do something with McLuhan in this pamphlet. What do you notice about the beginning? Was it a cul-de-sac, or I mean, I'll just read you the table of contents. Maybe that sparks something.
Okay.
I say we begin with McLuhan's ideas of the global village and where he got them from. Then we go into global theater, and most people end with that if they get that far with McLuhan, and they don't notice global membrane. And I add to global membrane, Android meme, phase one and two, and then the anthropomorphic physical, and then the tech body. Now, any commentary on that sequence?
Well, I mean, for me, the interesting thing about this is that it is a sequence. So as we've discussed in the past, I like to think of McLuhan in terms of all-at-onceness,
yeah.
And you tend to think in terms of a sequence like this. But what would be especially interesting to me would be to listen to whether you're able to translate this sequence into all-at-once mode, right? Is this sequence translatable into simultaneous percepts?
Okay. I would say that the global village is simultaneous under electric effects. And then when the satellite goes around the planet, that moves it to another level. So there's a simultaneity of the global village, but it's put inside a frame which actually moves it beyond simultaneity. Well, what do you call the co-anesthetic? That's what Donald Thiel's term is. You have the synesthetic interplay of the sensory modalities. Then the co-anesthetic is technology moving you to the director's seat, where you are able to. It's different from being the tactile organ that organizes synesthetically the sensory inputs. It is
How is it different?
Well, Thiel defines it as, I don't know where he got it from. I don't know if he quotes somebody. But the co-anesthetic is the fact that the person has more and more power over all these huge environments, which is where we ended up with the smartphone. You know, it all imploded and shrunk so that everybody was the director of their broadcasting. They were in the central position. Media were moving that way, and he called it co-anesthetic.
Yeah, so to me, this is is like the Finnegan's awakening.
Yeah.
Right, the difference between sin aesthetic and co anesthetic would be that there is a consciousness of the various modes that make up the synesthetic universe.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's like the awakening of the Finnegans. But what I don't understand is how there is seemingly something beyond that.
Okay. That's where I get into the global membrane and the Android meme. So so what you were just describing, becoming conscious, that's the co-anesthetic, like
right.
the orchestrator, the conscious orchestrator. So that is the global theater, beginning with the spaceship as a metaphor of the human floating around the planet but not inside it and not inside the media environments. He's starting to retrieve separateness.
Yeah. So that's like the satellite as the co, right? In co anesthetic.
Yeah.
So the co, at least in the past, often had a hyphen, right? If
yes.
it was co director or
yeah.
co whatever,
yeah,
it'd be co and then a hyphen, right? And so
yes.
the what you're talking about is the with the spaceship, the hyphen is
brought in.
The hyphen was always there, but it wasn't known to be there.
Right. No, that's good. That's the interval.
Yeah.
The hyphen
exactly.
be the interval. Okay, so yeah. then you get to the global membrane, which he uses, as far as I know, first in 64 in his review of Burroughs in December 64. The membrane is a further implosion and interaction, don't want to say ESP, but it might be, that expands. Maybe it takes the co-anesthetic and then expands on the synesthetic again. So it's more integrated.
Well,
you agree? That's what you were saying? You were saying yes, that's what you were thinking?
I sort of was thinking along those lines. But I was thinking of it more or less as an objection to what you were doing.
Right.
Because you were talking about a sequence, right? And whereas what I hear you saying just now and that I agree with is that it seems like there's a kind of breathing in and breathing out
yes.
going on here, where the blast off goes into satellite mode, which emphasizes the interval, the co, the
and
hyphen,
the separateness,
right?
Yeah.
And then with the membrane, I see this as a going back to the sin aesthetic,
yeah.
But emphasized, right?
That,
and so you have the going out to the satellite and then going back to a the same environment as before, but seen more clearly or seen more emphatically, something like that.
Right, and this is what in my essay, The Cloning of ESP, the blocking and merging dynamic. And McLuhan says this somewhere in the Dooline newsletters. You have the outer trip, cars, jets, airplanes, and satellites, while you have the inner trip, which is going into the extensions of the central nervous system, radio, TV, and maybe computer circuitry, and then the hologram maybe. So there is the outer trip of technology and the inner trip. But they're going to more and more come together. But the breaking point is when technology takes on a life of its own, in 1968 when he says they become living organic environments, that's a new separation, but it's not the human. Something is separating out from it, and then the human brings it back in through miniaturization in the digital era. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Brings it back
well,
into...
I like the idea of the breathing in and breathing out again.
Yeah.
Very much. I would just comment to the idea that there is an organic living reality to something that is not strictly human. That is not only an expansionary idea, it also goes into the interior landscape, and it does so because one of the things that can become conscious from the director's seat, from the satellite perspective, is that perceptions are dominant inputs. So it's not the case that humans have perceptions. Perceptions have humans.
Yeah.
And though, and perceptions are alive and are controlling and are huge. And I think what I hear you saying, McLuhan becoming conscious of after 68, is this side of perceptions.
Yep.
Percepts, I should say.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. And he lays that out in his art critic talk in 1970, August 70 in Ottawa, where he's telling them there's no more concepts possible. It's all percept. He's very extreme
right.
on that. That might be what you're getting at, or he was getting at.
I think I mentioned to you before, I found that online.
Yes.
And then it's just an image online, but... Then I digitized it and put it up in the blog in text. And what's interesting about that is that it provides a way out of the cul-de-sac. Because if the cul-de-sac is a product of concepts, and if it turns out that you can never have a concept aside from a percept, and if percepts are plural, that means that the cul-de-sac is a abstract construction that's not in any way necessary.
Right. No, very good. So then in the back of Take Today on the book sleeve, you'll see McLuhan or Barry writing a dialectic between software and hardware. And it's very important to notice when they put software in quotes and other times on the page not in quotes, and hardware is in quotes and not in quotes. The positioning of the quotation marks is important, and I see that as moving to an etherealization, which is where I bring in the meme. So much of, you talk to computer experts, they say, we haven't invented anything in computers in 50 years. We haven't done anything. And I say, well, that's because you're living in software patterning, and people are so engaged in developing memes, the social order of the day, or some perception of it, because people, in McLuhan's definition of the brain, they had the meaning part. They wanted to see the big picture as well as the details. So the meme, software patterns, or what McLuhan would say, finding out what's going on, and he says in some interview somewhere that today our only job will be to know what's going on.
Where it's at.
Yeah, it was where it's at was what he used to say. But then he said just keeping up and knowing what's going on, not even knowing where it's at, just what's going on, that means a knowing. And that to me sounds like a meme. And that took over the last 30 years, which frustrated hardware developers, the moon program. All these things were subsumed into this endless production of memes, which now the kids do daily on a tinier and speeded up level. You know what I mean? Process memes every 8 minutes, say, or every 5 hours. But it was slower in the 60s and 70s. But definitely the invention of hardware was knocked off a bit. And so the what was called inflation or jobs being sent out to China or someplace was actually the Android meme taking over. And everybody was engaged in what McLuhan would call surveillance. And espionage became our daily activity. That's what I'm saying we get to with the Android meme. And then the Android
So let me just say here that as you talk, I'm constantly trying to translate what you say in linear terms into synchronic terms.
Yes.
Right? And so what I hear you saying there is that when the better view or the better observation of percepts is possible from a satellite perspective, but that better view is not necessarily for the better.
Right.
There are many ways in which that view becomes distorted.
A despot. McClune calls it the despot somewhere in Take Today.
Yeah, exactly. That's very much like Jungian psychology calling these kinds of
archetypes.
Well, speaking of dominance, right? Despot and dominance go together. A despot is a authoritarian figure, and a dominant is a god that is per se authoritarian.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So
condition. We need to keep up. That's the despotic tyranny we're inside of. It's not bureaucratic. It's not freedom of speech. It's the pressure to have a sense of what's going on, because we're constantly making. We know unconsciously we're making sense, not matching, and we have to tune into what's been made. And so news monopolized that, the word that makes the market, McClune called it. But there was a battle of over what was more important. And so you had endless conferences in all the fields, everybody trying to say what the role of their field was in relation to the Android meme, and how could they become an Android meme or a meme. But it was Android and robotic and post-human. Post-something, post-chemical body was the process. I mean, can you see that? We are people, they spend their time the last 30, 40 years knowing what's going on. Now, did Eskimos do that or the Inuit? They were out there freezing and in their igloos, and then a storm would come or not, and then they'd say, oh, we got to go get those seal or whatever they hunted. Is that a state of a constant paranoia and involvement in exploiting the environment? You know, is that where we are today, exploiting what's going on? I mean, know what's going on.
When I translate this into my synchronic mode, one of the first things I do is think that if we speak about today, or if we speak about Eskimos 500 years ago or something like that, we're always talking about something that is very, very complex, right? So there were dumb Eskimos and there were smart Eskimos. There were Eskimos that were smart about hunting but dumb about what to talk about in the igloo, and there were people that were great in the igloo but shitty in hunting, right? So
yes.
Very, very complicated situation, and we can't talk about the Eskimos. And similarly with today, I think that what you're talking about is definitely something that's going on, but is it going on as if there was nothing else going on? No, I don't think so. I think what you're doing is you're pointing out that there are aspects of the interior landscape which now are emphasized in particular ways which have taken over,
yes.
Just as a weather front can sweep into an area and it basically takes over everything. That doesn't mean that there aren't other things there. It just means that they become inconsequential, right?
Well,
so
that's the
right
new ground.
That's right. But that doesn't mean that there, I mean, nowadays there can be a grandmother sitting somewhere who doesn't have an iPhone, doesn't know anything even about television or something, and who can be very, very intelligent. But she is disappearingly small in the overall weather front or overall solution that is modern history.
Yeah.
Right? So I see you talking about a aspect of what's going on that is, it's very clever the way that you talk about it and convincing, but I don't see it as history. I see it more like chemistry or more like
meteorology.
Meteorology. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay, so I'm a meteorologist.
Yeah.
What's the
and
problem?
A good one. Yeah.
So there is a sequence. What is the simultaneity of what I'm talking about, aside from the sequence? I mean, a later weather, a later ground comes in. I got Android Meme Phase 1, Phase 2, and the thing that we were always trying to be tuned into and figure out what's going on in the 60s, 70s, 80s, suddenly you didn't have to know what was going on. It took on a life of its own. It went somewhere else, and what it was made up of, chemical bodies weren't involved in it. So that's where I say the second phase of the Android meme of the weather is the technology start doing it to themselves, creating Android memes, so to speak, something like that. They're engaged in themselves, and this leaves people with no reference point or no ground other than whatever obsession they can find. And that, then, mm-hmm. then people start becoming eccentric, isolated, and antisocial, and robotic, and all the things that villages 150 years ago would not understand.
Right. And so you could say, one way of taking that would be to say that it's a concrete embodiment of the cul-de-sac.
Yes.
And so once we say it's a concrete embodiment of the cul-de-sac, we can say it's one property of the percept that takes itself to be a concept. Right? So that's, now we have a synchronic or all at once view of what you're talking about. It's a translation of it. You're giving a what might be called the phenomenology of it in the present world, and I am trying to do the chemical formula of that possibility.
Yeah.
There's nothing in your sequence that is outside the possibilities of existence, and so my interest is in those possibilities. Your interest is in the sequence of their manifestation.
Yeah, the and how we get to the tech body. So more and more, humans aren't able to figure out the weather. Maybe that's the way to say it. And then the weather started to manifest this. Actually, I just realized that's what everybody says all the time. I can't tell what season it is, right? I just made a discovery. That's why I've updated my meteorological position. And it's proved in the pop culture where it's a commonality the last 20, 30 years that people are, you know, experiencing winter in May and July, and it's all mixed up. Now,
right.
I had an interesting...
I noticed that...
Go ahead.
In both the exterior landscape and the interior landscape.
Yeah, and they're getting all mixed up. Now, now when I say they get all mixed up, they're getting mixed up. All I have to do is go back and see McLuhan already stated that. He said the inner and outer would get mixed up, public and private awareness. So what I'm developing, you can see the elements, the basic elements, are already in McLuhan. He's got it covered. It's like the way he would say about Finnegan's Wake, it had every technology that was possible was in Finnegan's Wake. You know what I mean? That would be coming.
Yeah, yeah, that's why the all-at-once view needs to see, it doesn't matter if it's in Joyce or in McLuhan or Hegel or Plato, the question is, do the range of possibilities that these people see cover all the eventualities? And one of your tasks in life is to bring out eventualities that people may not have seen.
That's right. Yeah, I'm trying to find out what's actually new from the Eternals. Now,
Not new from the Eternals. It's new, unremarked.
Yes, okay. It's in there somewhere, but it hadn't been noticed. I like this point that the weather's mixed up. Did people experience that in Aristotle's time? Maybe once 10 years, some weird anomaly happened. No.
But that's taking it too literally. The Greeks were very conscious of the fact that political constitutions were very finite, right? Unlike modern America that seems to think that American democracy is the be-all and end-all of political forms in the universe, the Greeks knew that democracy would self-destruct. And if you think of civil war and of the breakup of empires, Thucydides is largely a history of the breakup of the Athenian Empire.
Yeah.
Right. And so the Greeks were very conscious of weather, but not in a literal sense. They were conscious of it. Right. If tragedy is the weather of the internal landscape and civil war and war of the empire is exterior weather, then you can say that the Greeks knew more about weather than we do.
Okay. So this source told me that the seasons are getting mixed up because nature is trying to keep up with the speed of our perceptions. Technologically created. And so it didn't know what season it was, trying to keep up with us, because we were synesthetically hallucinating or altering or mixing up the dynamics more and more. So I always keep that in mind of what I'm trying to describe, that whatever nature is, because there's nature that is not what's categorized or an effect of visual space, and then there's visual space nature. But the holistic thing.
And then there's nature is seen from the satellite where it's disappeared.
Yes. And so all those factors are being caused by humans. So you come to this point, this crazy statement in Take Today, which I think I brought up, where we have arrived at the recently achieved forms of consciousness. That's in italics in the last at the end of the book, Take Today. Remember I brought this up before?
Yes.
Yeah. What could be forms of consciousness? Well, that would be humans making things as they felt more removed from the process. But if they understood then they could say, yeah, we're making this. But the tech body is something that has really made us think that we can't control it. So people have said for 50 years things are out of control. I remember people saying that in the 60s. Technology is out of control. Well, we've refined that and made it more threatening or more real with each new Android meme phase, which was a result of the miniaturization and digitization and hologramization of everything. And you can see this is what Bucky Fuller would talk about or other thinkers. I'm always interested in how we think past them. Can we get past them? Maybe the difference is that their crisis is not as bad as ours.
Well, I think you said a whole lot there that would require some
parsing. What would McLuhan say?
Yeah.
Wait, what was his phrase? We need to, you know, he had a phrase for that. We need to break that down a bit, Bob. Let's.
I hope he would say we need to step back.
Yeah. Oh, is that what he say?
I don't know. I don't know.
Let's step
but
back.
But in any case, I think we need to step back from what you said. And I think the key to trying to decipher all that is the word making.
Yes.
Right. Because when McLuhan talks about making, he is not at all talking about making from scratch.
Right.
Right. He is talking about the fact that when we see the truth of things, we don't see the truth of things as a matching. We're not capable of matching. So we see the truth of things as making, but people screw up that percept in two different ways. Sometimes they think, well, we're making it, therefore there's nothing there. Or they say we're making it, therefore we don't know what is there. And both of those are wrong, because making is fully capable of true perception, but it needs to be appreciated as something, as brought up at the end of Take Today and the end of Finnegan's Wake, as a keys to given.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So what happens with making when it is dislodged from an allegiance? No, when it's dislodged from an allegiance to what is given,
yeah,
then making gets out of control.
Well, that's definitely
making,
what I meant. Saying you're repeating me, I think.
Okay, could be.
Complimentary
I'm
words.
I'm trying to learn from you, Bob.
No, I like what you say. That concretizes what I thought I was saying. But yeah, we got too much making. I you know, they used to, 100 years ago, they complained about consumer mania, people being too passive, too much of consumer uniformity. I've seen the last 20, 30 years, we're in producer mania over making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's this, I've heard about some thinking group, I don't know what they're called, Rebel Wisdom, Intellectual Dark Web. Some of those guys, they use the term sense-making, and I don't know if they use the word sense-matching, but they're trying to find out what's happening with meaning, and they came up with sense-making. And they don't know anything about McLuhan, but McLuhan had that already, sense-making.
Absolutely. But I wonder if most people on the intellectual dark web, I don't think would mean sense-making in a good way.
Right.
Maybe Jordan Peterson would, another Albertan-born University of Toronto professor, by the way.
Well, you know, he's
like
the exact, he's the mirror image or the opposite of McLuhan.
Well,
I told you about
know.
This? It's an interesting
I'll just remind you one thing, Bob. When we started, you said something about your time being limited.
Yes.
I'm fine to go on, but.
I've got another 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Good. So talk about Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. I didn't know where he's from. He's from Alberta?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Born west of Edmonton.
Okay. So you have McLuhan. He is seen, I call him the Madison Avenue icon, Madison Avenue's version of him, as someone who is explaining the disappearance of visual space. And people think he's for the disappearance of it, but he's an expert on what's coming new. the masked man, which is not just limited to tribal space. So he is a guy coming out of visual space who's an expert on what's coming and what we're losing with visual space. He comes out of the University of Toronto. 50 years later, it's a different world. It's now been, okay, the visual space world was the given in the first half of the 20th century for normal consciousness. And then there's the radicalization by the global theater, and McLuhan's on top of that. Now, the takeover of the masked man, tactile autonomy mixed in with the merger creates a need for an anti-environment. And so visual space is retrieved. And it comes out of the University of Toronto, and that's Jordan Peterson, doing providing an anti-environment like McLuhan, but in the opposite direction. He's trying to figure out, can we save visual space? And McLuhan's wondering whether can we save tribal space, because he knows we're even going beyond tribal space. So it's interesting that these two phenomena come out of the same place, Toronto.
Right.
Now, I don't know if
I agree that the parallels between the two of them are interesting. Sometimes a picture of them looks very similar as well.
Oh yeah.
Let
before you say any more, I forgot this part. They're both misinterpreted. McLuhan is, the Madison Avenue icon of McLuhan is all wrong. And everybody spends the rest of the next 20 years finding out that McLuhan wasn't what they thought he was. Well, it turns out, I've seen a few YouTubes, I haven't read his book or anything, but I picked up a lot from people talking about him, what his general pattern is. And he was totally misinterpreted, it seems. Even got sick over it. Just like McLuhan got sick. So his Madison Avenue image is way more complicated than what people thought they were consuming.
That's right. I can't remember what the disease that Peterson first got was, but it's rats. I wish I could remember the word, because it's an interesting word and I'd never heard of it before. But
yeah.
It basically means uncontrollable restlessness.
Did you say breathlessness or restlessness?
Restlessness.
Restlessness. Kinetic.
Yeah. So that, yes, it's an inability to sit, an inability to stay in the same place for any more than a couple minutes or something like this. I've seen a description of Peterson by his daughter that could have been applied perfectly to McLuhan in the 60s and 70s. And in fact, in Judith Fitzgerald's book on McLuhan, she describes him exactly like that. Right after the 1960 stroke, you have somebody that's basically unrecognizable because he's become so frenetic. He cannot sit still. He cannot abide loud noises.
Right.
He is fidgeting all the time. And then you flick over to the description of Peterson by his daughter, and it's identical.
Wow.
Right? So it's if, speaking in your terms, I could say that the tech body took over these guys because they were threatening to, usurp its function or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it came to possess these guys.
Yeah, they both were trying to be anti-environments to their situation, but were seen to promote it, what they thought they were being an anti-environment to. Peterson, he's not promoting the... The hive mind or something. what Trump and them call communists or socialists, right? The socialists take it over. The hive mind. the political correctness of that or the cultural correctness. I don't think Peter is definitely not seen as promoting that. So
no, of course not.
But he's seen as something outside of it. So, and McLuhan was not seen as someone outside of it. So I'm looking for opposites in the two phenomena.
Yeah, but I don't know that you're going to find them, because I think that they have a lot of commonalities.
Okay.
A lot of commonalities. So, for example, Peterson is a very big fan of Jung.
Yes.
And he talks about Jung a lot. And McLuhan doesn't talk about Jung all that much, but McLuhan's notion of percept is pretty close to what Jung meant by an archetype, actually.
Okay.
McLuhan did, in the 1940s, did talk a fair amount about Jung and was clearly influenced by him.
Yeah, up to the point of, Harold Bloom wise saying, no, Jung missed it. There's other aspects that I'm going to point out that Jung missed about the archetype, and maybe the materiality of it, of the environment.
Could well be. I mean, McLuhan didn't take Jung at his word, right? Jung was a very influential figure very early in the century. His essays were translated already before the First World War, some of his early essays. And, people read them and were intrigued by this different way of looking at psychology.
Yeah.
But then nearly everybody sort of chewed on them for a while and came up with, their own version.
Yeah, I was just thinking, was the criticism of McLuhan, his impersonalness, his failure to deal with the individual, Jordan fills that in. But Jordan, he misses the collectivity that's going on. As McLuhan pointed out, the causes of it. So they complement each other about the popular perception of each one of them and what they're missing. The other guy fills in what Peterson missed or McLuhan missed. So what is it about Canada? Let's see if there's something here about Canada's in the interval. It's the borderline case, as McLuhan said, and that means, up against all kinds of multiple interfaces. So that the figure is actually the center for culture and technology. Now, we're in a tech body situation, so Canada can't be its wonderful image of itself since Trudeau is the peacemaker in the middle of it all. I don't think Canadians realize that's gone. But go back a step.
Western Canadians know it's gone, believe me.
Right. So I was going to say that you go back a step before the tech body. We have two media interval thinkers, McLuhan and Peterson. Peterson's in the interval of probably the anthropomorphic physical, because what we've seen as the Android meme shrunk and disappeared, fooled everybody and disappeared, you have people arguing over chemical body properties. Are you hetero, homo, this or that? Multiple, and you have race retrieval arguments, and what else? Body processes, health. What's a proper diet? So the body is ripped apart and argued over, even though it's not there anymore. So McLuhan and Jordan were mediators, center of the cultural and technological interface. In both cases, but in the opposite directions, opposite purposes. So Canada was that. It was the great, they called it the great peacemaker, but no, it was the thing that wasn't a nation and could tolerate everybody, so to speak. Wasn't in the argument. Are you there?
Yeah, I am, but yeah. I didn't follow you. You went from not being the peacemaker to being a divided country and having all sorts of different people in it. But those two things seem like a fair definition of peacemaker to me.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah. But I don't think the word peacemaker is accurate. That's a hardware thing, stopping wars. No, Canadians were good at being the mediator in the software meme argument, in the discussion, in the endless talking heads. It had an image of fairness and interest in everybody. Americans don't have that image. They're aggressive. They take over. They're what McLuhan called kinetic and manipulatory. So that interval position, I used to call Canada the Switzerland of the solar government. You know, the gnomes of Zurich were the were in Switzerland, and they were of the secret world government on the finance banking level. But we moved beyond that into the orbiting economy, and Canada is the Switzerland of that new...
It would like to think of itself as that anyway.
Oh, yeah, well, and people like to think of Canada that way. Yeah, it was all agreed.
That's right.
This is in the...
Yeah, but it isn't.
No, I agree. But the point is, the in the last stages of humans thinking that they could still manage a situation, they had to assign roles. So Canada had that role. And everybody praised Canada. But none of it worked.
Right.
I see McLuhan didn't work, and Jordan doesn't work. No anthropological or anthropomorphic thinker is up to speed of what we're dealing with. So that's what my book... And that's represented by Donald Trump. He's the president we can't deal with. Or post-president.
Okay.
As the tech body.
As always, I'm sitting here. Well, the problem is I'm trying to translate this into synchronic mode, right?
Okay.
All at once mode. And I'm fine when you talk about something getting out of control or not being controllable or something like this.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem seeing that as the natural extension of certain structures that are all at once possibilities in the interior landscape. I have no problem seeing that and thinking that you're talking about good stuff. But towards the end of your talk, you seem to insist on on sequence as the essence of what was going on, of how, say, McLuhan and Peterson were failures, and Trump is able to trump their
no, I don't see
lack
Trump
of
as success.
A success.
People thought they understood McLuhan. They still hoik him up. Well, this guy's good. He makes sense of the world. And others think Peterson makes sense. They're missing how they don't make sense. And that's the mystery of Trump. He doesn't make sense, and he doesn't necessarily solve it. But he's able to hijack the process and be the figure. I mean, whoever thought, 50 years ago, you won't have Nixon to kick around again. Oh, yeah, we'll have Trudeau, we'll have Jimmy Carter, Reagan to kick around. But they're actually worried, and it's journalistic people get paid to write articles about what are we going to do after Trump's gone? Who the heck has ever been that important that we're fearful that we don't have any reason to be news agencies anymore? Which shows you that what news people do, they complain they're just giving opinions. No, they're processing the meme, the Android meme. They're trying to process the thing that's come alive and has taken over everything, and that's why they don't do old-fashioned journalism or investigative reporting. They're just there to help people talk through the craziness of each day. And so you rear-view mirror and say, CNN's nothing but opinions, or Fox News, nothing but opinions. Well, that's the only way you make consciousness. By talking. So McLuhan's dream of conversation being the greatest art has won and taken over. And Frank Zappa is wrong when he said music is the best. Conversation is the best.
So 1807, Hegel published a book called The Phenomenology of Spirit, right?
Yes.
Phenomenology Disguistus.
Yeah.
And what he tried to show is that in the in history, you can see how mind comes to terms with itself. And he shows that there's many dead ends that mind gets into. There's many contradictions. There's many riddles, on and on and on like this. And so as I listen to you, I hear somebody talking about the phenomenology of mind brought up to date.
Yes.
Right?
I agree with
you
that.
Talking, how does mind wrestle with itself and try to understand what's going on with it? And, you know, I find it insightful and enjoyable.
Very good. Well,
yeah.
we will continue.
Yes, sir.
I think I've reached my limit. I have to do some stuff.
I understand. Yeah. Good.
Oh.
Well, keep up the good
did
work.
Did we get it? Beg your pardon?
I say keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks. So we are discussing the book, aren't we? We're doing
That's
it.
That's right.
All right. We got there.
In our own odd way. Odd fellows.
Yeah. And,
so listen, next week, one housekeeping thing. Next week is the 24th. Are we going to talk then, or is that too close to Christmas to do?
No, I don't celebrate much in Christmas, so it's not a big deal. But I'll tell you that if I'm available, and you'll say whether you're available. If not, we'll do it then we get into New Year's Eve.
So
right. We'll see. So, let's just see what happens.
Okay, we'll just leave it open.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Cameron. Another great talk.
Okay. You too, Bob. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.